Welcome, everyone, to episode number 92 of Underserved. With me in studio today is Jan Robert, partner at Saptopia. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Jan, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Andrew, thanks for having me.
And a special bonjour from JP Beaudry, former Underserved guest and fellow Université de Sherbrooke alum.
Bonjour, JP.
So when you were back there in university or even earlier in Quebec, like what was it like growing up there? Was there much tech or excitement about it?
In high school, I think when we really started to be having a lot of tech, one of my friends was dismounting, you know, building PCs and components. And I thought that looked cool, but a bit complicated for me. I wasn't into it very early in my childhood or during high school. It actually caught up to me, you know, in my late 20s, I would say.
Okay. And what were you doing then?
I studied in communications, and I had this job at a small forestry company in Sherbrooke, and I was handling all the communications, the marketing. And then it was the time, 95, 96, so people were trying to make websites for small companies, and my boss said, hey, we need a website. I don't know where to go, but hey, there's this course, you know, you want to go there and then maybe build their website. So I learned HTML, PHP, and things like that. Exciting times. I built their website, and I fell in love with technology and decided to start my small company in Sherbrooke. Maybe within a year, I started from scratch and I was fully into web development and e-commerce tools and portals. And it was a very young industry at the time.
Yeah, everything was growing so quickly then. Like, who were your customers?
Well, we had this 60,000, 80,000 population down, and we had this nice hockey team, and I built their website. So there was this guy close to the rink with a PC, and he was entering the scores and the penalties and all. And that was like pretty much one of the first sites to do that in Quebec, and the results were live. So we also had a hockey equipment company, a retailer, that we built a site where people would go on the site, they would build their equipment, and they would get a quote in their email. And the company I was serving also got the quote in their fax machine, because at the time it was more convenient to get the fax to print it out right near the counter. Restaurant websites, ads, all kinds of new things that people really felt were nice, interesting, but it was really all foreign or alien to people at the time. So I was talking to companies, they wanted a website because it was cool, but they really didn't know if they would make any money out of it. Honestly, it was a little bit too complicated for them at the time.
They all knew they wanted to hang their shingle out there, and yep. There was websites that were directories of other websites like Yahoo. How did you fit into the landscape there?
Well, it's funny. We went the opposite route. So we created a local portal. So it was like a local Yahoo. We called it La Toile Sherbrooquoise. So the local companies would actually buy a spot there. We would sell them websites. We had an ad section, news groups. People would talk together. So we had about 2,000-3,000 people that were coming to the site and buying local product. I even had a journalist. So I hired a journalist that was covering news, like any traditional newspaper. We thought it was going to be like that. We thought like local companies could sell on the web to people around them. It's funny because we're 25 years later and people are talking about it still, but that really never took off.
But you met someone who was kind of doing a Canadian Craigslist, and what was that experience
like? That's sometimes you have a funny thing to tell, and if you look at it, doesn't make you look so good, right? So I'm with this guy that calls me. He says, hey, I have this local ads, you know, website that I've built, and I'd like to have lunch with you because I think your portal is great, and maybe we could link up our tools together. So I had lunch with him and then came back to my office, and my partner explained to him, and he said, well, not sure. And, you know, our conclusion was, you know, we're going to eat this guy alive. So no reason to have any venture with another guy. We'll have our ads. Actually, the 5-6 years later, that guy sold his ad for about $20 million, I think, to Videotron. So it is funny, but it's, you know, I'm not telling everybody all the time.
Yeah, hey, you know, hindsight's 2020. I invested in a company, I think in like 2011, and it was either give them the money or buy Bitcoin. I really wish I'd bought the Bitcoin.
Yeah, some friends of mine bought Bitcoin. I thought it was too complicated and nobody would believe any of that. Some of my friends have a few Bitcoins, and I don't ask them how much they're worth now.
So after college, I think you end up working for the telecom giant Ericsson?
Yeah, actually, that's when I sold my small company. I wasn't making a fortune out of it in my small town, right? And I decided to go to Montreal. My best friend and partner said, you know, you can do it. You know, just go back to school and just get a real job in Montreal because that's where actually, you know, the action is. And Ericsson was a great place to start your career. You would be in projects with, you know, all kinds of different resources. You get to learn system administration, programming, system integration. I was able to get the Cisco certification. Also, the Unix, Linux was starting. We were building products on stacks of new Linux servers. It was very interesting to be there because you, as a newcomer to IT, would learn all the processes that big companies adhere to, best practices that even today, I don't always see that in companies I've worked with. You know, Ericsson was really way out of the game for a lot of process and tools.
I am pro big company for like one of your first jobs because they have the resources to do things right. They have build and release. They have version control. They have all these processes. I say learn them all and then figure out what you want to keep when you move on from there.
Right. True.
So you're doing like testing and like voicemail systems, TDMA, CDMA, what other sort of stuff?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was able, with the teams I was working with, we would build systems from the ground up, telecom systems. At the time, it was TDMA. They were talking about CDMA. Edge was a word you would hear sometimes. That's really like where we were. And all those cell phones would come up with screens and you would start to be able to exchange images or text. And unfortunately, all the different brands did not have the same capabilities. One would show JPEG, one would show PNG, one would show GIF, and there was what we called transcoding. So I became like the resource in Montreal that knew how transcoding worked. So I was leading those projects and it was interesting because friends of mine would be, you know, at a dinner and they would share multimedia messages and I would know exactly how it worked behind the scenes. That was really cool. It led me to management eventually because I really discovered also that I wanted to lead teams. That brought me back to some of my previous studies or works that I did because I was more of a people's person actually. So I had to choose at one point if I would stay more in technology or if I would go with management. And that branch actually occurred to me around 2005, 2006. I had to make a choice at one point.
I'd say 9 out of 10 people, myself included, end up going the management route. It's hard to just stay technical forever.
Sometimes if you're good on the technical side, they'll see that you're going to lead other technical people, right? And start careers and, you know, you're going to be able to manage those people. So they trust you're able to do it and people will trust that you are. So they'll give you an opportunity to lead them.
And so was it that leadership experience that had you moving on to Tyco a couple of years later?
Yeah, actually, it was a bad time for telecom. So if you remember, around the start of the 2000s, there were a lot of telecom companies were struggling. That's when Nortel went down. And Ericsson was not different than anywhere else. So the 6 years I was at Ericsson, I saw numerous rounds of people getting cut. And the project management office was where I would have liked to go. But everyone I saw go there was getting cut. So if you were the last one in, guess what happens, right? So I avoided moving up to the Ericsson company at the time because of that reason. So an opportunity showed up at Tyco, which was closer to my house, also on the south shore of Montreal. And I decided to try it out.
And so what are you doing at Tyco? Did you make it to the PMO?
Well, I actually was the only project manager there and I got my training on the job because the general manager was pretty knowledgeable and he was very seasoned project manager before he was GM. Very tough guy, by the way. Made my life really miserable for 2.5 years. He told me I was going to suffer. You know, he didn't hide it from me. He said, you know, you're going to become a PM. You're going to be a good PM, but I'm going to make your life miserable and you will hate me every day.
And you still took the job.
Yeah, I was looking for a challenge. And, you know, now I see that. And whenever anyone talks to me like that, you know, usually I turn around now. But you're young. You want to prove yourself. You want a challenge. And you think, you know what? Hey, I'm wise enough. I'll figure it out. We made great progress at that company. We turned around the product delivery cycles. You know, they used to deliver one software release a year. And we ended up delivering 4 a year. And it was working fine. But at one point, you get tired if the culture is what it is, right? You don't change the culture in a company. You either live within the culture, or if you don't adhere to it fully, you got to find a place where you really fit.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
Now, for folks that don't know, Tyco makes like fire and security access control and so on. And they had done a lot of acquisitions. And in the pre-call, you mentioned it was almost like a Darwinian process. They would buy like a couple companies and then make them compete against each other.
Actually, that was also the case at Ericsson. It's funny because some companies, I think maybe it was common at the time in the early 2000s, Tyco certainly did that. They bought a company in Quebec, which was called Cantech. And they also had a company in Lexington here in Massachusetts that's called Software House. We were competing within the same portfolio. We were having frequent conversations with those guys. And honestly, we thought our product was better, but they were very much better at marketing themselves. So within Tyco, they were shining. We thought for no reason, but we weren't very good at marketing. So sometimes the image is also very important.
Were you able to take the good facets of your product and push them into theirs? Or how did they ever combine?
I think not. They remain different technologies. And when I left, I don't even remember the product would talk to each other. You could not install a Software House device on a Cantech software. It didn't really work.
All right. So after a few years there, what do you decide to do next?
Well, actually, I decided to try out an SAP project. So there was a nice SAP project that was starting South Shore also of Montreal, a company called Uniselect, which is a company founded in, I think, the 1960s in Quebec. It's a co-op for auto parts. And that company was growing and they had purchased another company in the US and they just got SAP licenses and they were starting a project. It was huge. They were actually replacing a 40-year-old system with a new SAP implementation. They had to go deploy all the distribution centers in Canada, one after the other. Yeah, I wanted to try something in the SAP sector, and that was a really good introduction to what SAP does and, you know, all the challenges you will face in a complex environment like this one.
Now, you said you did it kind of piece by piece. A lot of times it's much easier if you slam the implementation everywhere, but that just wasn't possible.
Some companies, they will grow by acquisition, right? And you end up with a gigantic system, a legacy system that is sometimes comprised of different data and different processes. And you cannot necessarily take the whole, and it's like an elephant, right? You'll eat it, you know, one bite at a time. So they went with a smaller distribution center, knowing that if it went awry, they could fix it and the financial impact would be less. So you call that a proof of concept in technology. Sometimes you go with a smaller product, you just try it out on, you know, in production. And if you don't regret it, you put more of it, right?
Throw more gas on the fire.
That's right.
Now, you spent some time in the banking industry after that.
Yeah. In your career, you have an opportunity sometimes to build the tools for your work. And in a project management office, there are project management tools. So it happens that Uniselect did not have project management tools to actually manage finance, schedules, resources. And during my passage at Uniselect, I had developed with VB on Excel, I had developed a full suite of project management processes and tools. And there was a project, actually, National Bank of Canada, where they were deploying a real product for that. So the PMO at the bank was purchasing PlanView, which is what they call an EPPM, which actually they call it a Microsoft project on steroids. So it's a big system to implement at a company, but you manage all your resources, all your projects, your portfolio. You get to see the whole of the program for the company. So you can do a lot with that system. I wanted to try it out, see what that kind of application in a big company could do. So I ended up 2.5 years on that project. We delivered the whole series of applications and we had to train all the sectors of the bank, and it's a very political environment. So it was also something for me to learn to work in the organization itself. As a PM, you get a role, a mandate, but if you're touching PMO and the PMO is actually deploying to all the business units, then you have a lot of things to learn from the organization side.
And so that's what you do like the next 6 years or so. You do a lot of like SAP and Oracle implementations after that?
Yeah. You know, at one point I thought SAP was a good place to be because there was a lot of exciting projects, big projects. It was interesting for me because I liked the atmosphere of a big project. You know, after one or two mandates, you know how it goes, right? People see your resume, they only see the top few lines. And if it says SAP once or twice, then people call you for SAP. So that's pretty much, you know, I just surfed on that wave in the last 12 years now. So different projects, different companies, but always the SAP wave.
And what sort of industries are you working in then?
Actually, I've been at Parexel, which is a company here in close to Boston for two mandates. Worked in a paper company, Cascades. Also worked again at Uniselect twice because when you're consulting, sometimes you just go back. People want you back and you're happy to go back and people recognize you. So I went back to Uniselect and there was this big project a year and a half ago at BRP. So I don't know if you know BRP. They're making snowmobiles, ATVs.
Was that Bombardier?
It's actually a spin-off of Bombardier from 10 years ago. So it's now a separate company, but indeed people confuse Bombardier with BRP, but they had this huge project as well that I actually exited about a year ago. So yeah.
Did you get any cool snowmobiles out of it or anything?
Well, actually you had to be an employee. But if you're an employee of BRP, a snowmobile doesn't really come at a very high cost. It's really interesting for those guys.
It's too bad you had the wrong color badge.
I think I'm still happy with our Nimbooling Duck. The flexibility, you know, and the freedom of being your own small business, right? Is something I wouldn't give away, I think, anymore.
You mentioned like going back to a previous customer multiple times. Like, yeah. You know, when I've been consulting, like that's always one of my favorite things. It's like, all right, no interview, no nothing. Just hop in and get right back to work.
Yeah. And it's interesting because if you're going back, it's because something good you did, right? And when you come back, you get emails by former colleagues. Hey, you're going to be back. Let's have lunch. And it's fun. It's like you're coming back home. So that's really something I've enjoyed a few times.
Now, you mentioned on the pre-call, a lot of the projects you did, though, were what you called a recovery project. What was that like?
Yeah, well, that also stuck to me. So SAP and recovery. So it comes from the fact that somebody calls you and says, you know, I have a project, but it's not easy. We need a guy to recover it because it's failing right now. It's failing big time. There's two ways to see that. You know, either you say, okay, this is going to be tons of work and I'm going to try to be a genius here. Or you could play the other cards. You could say, you know what, if it's failing, there's a few things that led to that. Let's talk about it. And I was lucky enough to have customers that recognized they made mistake leading to that project failing. And I was able to get decisions early on. And that's pretty much my signature for having so many recoveries, is that I was able to renegotiate conditions of the project when I started, instead of just taking it and trying to steer it back into the path. So I think people recognize I was good at that, you know, and if the project wanted to still fail, I was able to find, you know, ways to do it. But honestly, it's very demanding on the people's skills. A lot of times it's not technology, it's people. So either you don't have the right people or the people, they don't want it to succeed. There are people that within projects, they may not know it, you know, consciously, but some people are not geared up for succeeding because of various reasons. You have to figure that out and you have to help those people turn it around. And so it's demanding in terms of personal investment. People called me about it and they said, well, you're good at that. Would you like to do one more? And like, oh, okay, well, you know, it's also good. People recognize you. So you say, okay, I'm going to do it. Now, nowadays, if they call me for recoveries, I'm not sure I would do any more recoveries now. You know, I'm getting older. It's a little bit tougher every day.
Former underserved guest Mike Bro said that in his teenage years working at an auto repair shop, they had the super jobber quote, and that was the insanely high price that you would give to someone if they asked you to do some job you didn't want to do.
Yeah, well, I haven't thought of that, but I don't think the money is the reason I would do it again.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem, though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hi, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Shrinks. Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Meris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Meris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Meris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers to project managers to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Meris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Meris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
Now, you met some good folks, including Min Yu, during these assignments?
Yeah, actually, Min, when you talk about project recoveries, Min helped me recover a strategic project in 2013. So I had to make those choices I mentioned, early tough choices within a project that was, honestly, was losing many million dollars of investment. And the customer gave me, you know, he said, well, I'm going to trust your judgment. You make the call. So there were like three vendors and I selected one, which is always tough. But the vendor that stayed, Min, is actually the guy that pulled it off. So we worked together. I was tough on him for quite a few months, but we made it work. And we stayed in relation over the years. And twice we worked together again. Even last year, he came back to one of my companies and did also a great job. You know, some people, they follow you through your career. It's a guy from California, actually. So what are the odds that I would meet him again, you know, three times in Quebec?
Oh, that is unusual. Now, in 2019, you made a fateful and fun decision to maybe check out of work for a little while. Tell us about that.
There was an opportunity. So we were taking care of parents that were ill, and my wife's mother passed away. We had a bi-generation house. She was living with us, and she passed away. The kids were gone. They were all in their 20s. They were all autonomous and they were working. And all of a sudden, we just realized that we were just working like robots and just going forward, just aging with work ahead of us until retirement. But that didn't really seem, at one point, we just looked at each other and did seem like a plan. It's like, why are we just doing that? Just because we're doing it? That doesn't justify it. So we were chasing dreams of things that would actually ask a lot more of us, you know, more work, more money, more this, more that. And told my wife, I said, well, if you just stop and you just turn, you know, 180 degrees and you look backwards, there's this other path there, which is much more simple. I mean, we just sell everything and we just walk away with two pack, you know, backpacks, and we just travel for some time and see where that leads us. And we decided to do that. Instead of chasing complexity, we decided to just turn around and just go with, you know, a little bit more of a mindful experience. Just try something different. So we took plane tickets, opened the blog. The blog was called One Way Ticket, and we just flew out to Asia.
And where do you land first?
Well, we actually land in India. So we decided to go all in to start off with. So India, we knew was going to be more of a cultural shock. We knew that already, but we were still shocked. So yeah, we spent a few weeks in India. You know, it's very hot. There's a lot of dust all the time. It's very noisy. It's never calm. It's never quiet. And there's a lot of confusion. I mean, if you're walking in the streets and you need to have a taxi ride to somewhere, or you're flying or just going to the restaurant, or sometimes very basic things, you end up in situations where you're confused. And it's not just us. I would say we called it the land of confusion for some time. And until we got used to it and we understood how things are, we felt like we were on Mars. It was very, very different. I didn't expect that because we traveled to many countries in the past and I never experienced such a difference in ways of living. That was very intense.
So after a few jarring weeks, you went to Nepal?
Yeah, we actually stayed in Nepal for 3 weeks. We did not go, you know, climb mountains or, you know, a lot of people go to Nepal and they want to climb mountains. We were a bit more lazy. We just felt like taking it easy. So we were in Kathmandu for a few days. Again, it's as intense as Delhi, I would say. they're rebuilding Kathmandu because of the earthquakes a few years back, and it's still very dusty, very noisy. So we flew to a place called Pokhara, and Pokhara is really laid back. There's a nice lake surrounded by mountains, a small city. A few backpackers go there, but it's very much of a quiet place, so you get to relax a lot. We took it easy for about 2-3 weeks there. That was cool.
Now, the next place I recognize the name, you went to Goa, like back to the beach?
Yeah, we actually, because India, we went to India in 2 different times. So when we arrived in India, we stayed around Delhi and we went to Rajasthan, which is more of a desertic area. Mm-hmm. We went to Nepal and then went back to Goa to get to, the beaches. And it's much more laid back than Delhi. You can't compare that, but it's still India. And it's funny because you're on the beach and there's these cows all over the beach and there's stray dogs, and it's very much difficult to explain. But again, there's all this confusion, but you're on the beach at least, right? There's the sunset and there's a little boy, you know, that sells the chai tea at the sunset. That's pretty magical, I would say. And it's not very complicated. There's no big resorts there. You don't feel like you're in Miami, clearly not.
Yeah, I've met a lot of nice Indian folks working in the software industry. I've always been curious about going there, but never made it. Maybe one of these days we'll have to pull the 180 and throw the backpacks on.
Well, one of my Indian colleagues in Delhi, when he knew we were traveling there, said, hey, you got to come to my place and we'll drive around and we'll have dinner in Delhi. And it's funny because we had visited Delhi by our own with tuk-tuk, you know, those little three-wheeler bikes, and we had some pretty difficult experience in some parts of Delhi because there are parts which are really very, very poor, and it was a little bit troubling, the experience we had. Whereas when we met with my colleague, and he brought us exactly to the same place one night, and when he said he would bring us there, we were like, oh, I'm not sure we want to go there. And he said, no, you come with me. And he knew the place, he knew the customs, he knew the people, and it was completely different. So if you are going to visit India, I strongly suggest that one of, you know, your colleagues, which is Indian that lives there, will show you around, and it's going to be amazing. And what I really remember about Indian people, and I really love that about them, is they are very proud of India. You know, I do not recall any single Indian that would tell me anything wrong about this country. And they're really all proud about any kind of thing. They've got tons of stories to tell you about their country.
Tend to be proud of their country, their culture, their family.
Yeah,
definitely. Now, you went to Thailand after that?
Yeah, Thailand. That time we decided to go north of Thailand. And it's funny because it was the end of 2019 and my wife fell sick. She felt really sick. We were close to the border with China and there was a lot of Chinese people traveling as tourists. And my wife fell sick and we had to go to the hospital because she was really not well. And they couldn't figure out what she had. Everything they tried on her for, you know, regular flu or cold or anything, nothing worked. And it took us about 4 to 5 weeks before she started to feel better, and she had to go 3 times to the hospital. We almost came back to Canada at the time because it was difficult to say if she was going to improve or not, and we couldn't figure out what she had. And in January, we started to hear about a disease coming from China, from people calling us from Quebec saying, hey, you know, there's a disease coming from China. You guys heard about it. And gradually we realized she probably was one of the first cases. We make fun of my wife. We say she's patient zero, but probably was close to zero.
Yeah. She's lucky to get through that.
Yeah.
So I imagine that kind of ends the jaunt around Asia and the wandering trip.
Yeah, well, actually, lucky enough, she felt better after some time, so we decided to keep going. You know, it was a decision that we took us a few days after she was well. If you think about it, we were going from Thailand. There are nice hospitals in Thailand. There's a good, you know, medical capability there, but we were going to Laos, and in Laos, there's a few small hospitals, but if you're really not well, you really have to go back to your country if you're in Laos. But we decided to keep going. We didn't regret it because Laos was a great country. It was nice. We had a good time there as well.
When do you decide to come home?
Well, actually, when Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, officially said we had to go back. Because there were some talks of going back in February. But the government of Canada was saying, well, you should think of maybe if you feel like it, come back if you'd like. And that didn't sound very official to me. And my wife was like, well, they're sort of telling us we should go back. And I was like, well, they're not very convincing. And I really had enjoying myself here. So we argued a bit, but we stayed. And we were in Bali at the time when eventually we received a message from Government of Canada saying, okay, you have to come back now. Because after the weekend, if you're not back, we cannot support you. We can do nothing for you because all the flights will have been canceled and then you're on your own. So I'm not more into risk than that. So we just purchased tickets and we came back.
Yeah, I think they closed the borders and everything for quite some time.
Well, there was the army everywhere also. In Thailand, we were in Bangkok waiting for a flight and the army was walking in the streets and it was really time to go. So tourists had all gone back and it was really time.
Well, you get back and luckily someone has some remote work for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the world we left was a world in which we had to go physically to our customers, right? Even in IT, I mean, sometimes I would have semi-remote work, but it wasn't the norm. And we were telling ourselves, well, someday when we get older, we'd like to have customers we can work remotely, even if it's not the same level of work. We'd like to have that. When we come back, it's COVID and everybody is remote. So we didn't have to change the world. It changed for us. Since we came back, my wife went to the office, I think twice. Same for me. My customers didn't even want to have us at the office, right? They weren't physically there. And even now, 2.5 years later now, and still my customers hardly have staff at the office. If you go there, you're pretty much on your own.
Yeah, a lot of folks said, you know what? Why are we paying for real estate? Everyone just stay home. We'll take the increased productivity. We'll deal with the fact that maybe you're not working all the time and assume that we're coming out ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I do like, you know, to work in person because especially when you start projects, you're building a new team. People don't know each other. I mean, you can be on a Zoom call, but that doesn't build a relation. You know, it just builds a connection for work. But being in person, you know, sharing lunch or dinner and just enjoying yourself, having an activity, just knowing if somebody's got kids or you hardly talk about that kind of stuff on a Zoom call, right? Mm-hmm. You could do it, but it's not natural. People don't feel the same connection. It's personal. I have friends from former jobs. I have a lot of friends. I don't know if I would make friends on a Zoom call.
Yeah, it's a different interaction. Zoom, it's way better than nothing. It's way better than just the phone, but there is some intangible about when you get together in person that it just can't quite bridge.
Yeah, the same like being in your studio.
Well, thank you for coming in person.
I'm happy.
Now, your colleague there, Min Yu, that you met many years ago, ends up coming back around with another opportunity, right?
Right. So Min's a great guy. He's one of those gurus that you find in different technologies, right? And Min was able to develop a nice little company in California. Well, he's got employees all over the U.S. So he built a nice company within the last 20 years on a product called Vistex, which is a subproduct of SAP. He's able to implement that technology with a team of senior resources that he's got on staff. He's been looking for a few years for somebody that had a good connection with him that would be interested in putting the company, you know, more on the forefront, right? And taking, you know, the relation with the customers, being more present for them, calling back, right? So he reached out to me, I think before COVID. He talked to me about it, but it wasn't serious at the time and it just left a seed. But last year we started talking a bit more seriously, the end of the year. Nothing certain at the time, but it's just in January and February before our vacation that I took the time to, you know, just call him and say, okay, what's that about? You know, let's talk seriously. And what would that mean? Honestly, I'm really happy because I think this is what I want to do now. I mean, I've been doing project management for 16 years. I met all these great customers. I've made relations with them and I've traveled. But project management, I think I've done it all in that area. So I was looking for something different and it brings me back. You know, if I'm to be developing a company, doing business development, it sort of brings me back to when I was 25, my first company. That's what I wanted to do. I've piled up 20 years or 25 years of experience after that first attempt. And I think I'm better positioned today to use my soft skills in that kind of challenge and see where that leads us, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's got the train in motion. It's just a matter of helping him move the train faster and add more cars.
Yeah, that's a good way to see it. I mean, I don't need to change the product. I actually just need to give it a little bit more spin or give it a little bit more traction in some areas. The network is there. The product is great. You know, the market is good. The role, I think, fits now. You work on the website. You work on LinkedIn. You actually talk to people. You go to conferences. You build relations and you see what happens after that. So that's something that I really feel like doing.
So the company is Saptopia, and you do VizTech's implementations all across the United States with domestic resources?
Yes. So we've got customers in the US, customers in Canada, could be customers in Europe, but now again, there's a time zone, right? So you really want to be available with your customer during their work hours. So naturally, it's more North America. So we've got people in various projects right this time and exciting projects coming along too.
Any other hobbies, any other little trips if you're not wandering the world for long periods of time?
Yeah, well, with the new business, I'm not going to wander with the world too much, but I do play guitar. I've always played guitar. My dad was a wedding singer. He was pretty renowned in my small city. So he would do these big parties or festivals or weddings, and they would practice in the basement when I was a kid. So I was baited in music, and my first guitar I got, I think I was 9 or 10 years old. Still have it, actually. My dad gave me that guitar and it stayed with me. So I still play with a $100 guitar that I still love to play. Eventually was able to buy a better one, but I still play it very often too, yeah.
Was your dad playing songs like in English or French or whatever popular?
Both. A lot of Western music or country music. It's not my favorite music type myself, so I play sometimes with him, but I'll just play along, right? Because he knows them all by heart. It's funny because my dad is 76. And he still plays at events. So my dad will go to retirement home and he would play there. And he comes to me, he says, oh, I've played for old people. So, you know, there's no age for that. But I think he doesn't know he's 76. So, but it's funny. I make fun out of that.
Age is just a number.
Yeah, I think it is.
So you missed out on a sailboat trip in 2020. Did you get to make good on that?
Yeah, actually, the sailboat was the next thing we would have done in Asia when we had to come back. It was all paid for. So we were lucky enough that the company is still in business and they're doing actually good nowadays. So we postponed twice. Remember, every year we thought it was good. And then we had bad news. We had to postpone to the following year. So we just went there in February. It takes at least 2 days to go and 2 days to come back. So you already take almost a week off. So we stayed for 3 weeks and we went down the islands of Thailand with a sailboat, my wife and I. It was a terrific experience.
That's pretty awesome. I remember the COVID delay. My daughters got into the Hamilton musical and we got all excited to bring them. So we bought tickets. We finally just went last month, I think.
Okay, what you did. Okay, so you went.
We made it.
Okay, nice. Same actors or?
It's a different crew than the original New York folks that like you see on the television special, but it was still every bit as amazing. We had a great time. So Jan, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks a lot, Andrew, for having me. It was a pleasure.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.